Thanks, Brenda. Brenda's going to play again when we read out some of the names of the dead from New York City, from Afghanistan, Iraq. September the 11th today. So very much focused on the attack on New York City, but also on the consequences of that attack and how it's been used to attack people in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And we also remember it's also the day of the CIA-sponsored coup in Chile in the 70s. So I'm going to introduce Harry, who's originally from New York City, to reflect on that and also to share experiences coming out of the Republican Convention in New York and the nonviolent resistance to that. We might actually gather in a bit closer because of the traffic noise and stuff.
Hi, how you doing? I was in New York last week. My sister was having a baby, so I was over to kind of be around and help out. And inevitably, it brought back the memories of 3 years ago, not long after she had her first child, and she, on September 11th, 2001, huddling in her front room with the windows down as a cloud of debris and smoke rolled down her street, and the sense of vulnerability that I felt for her and for all my loved ones in New York while I was here and hearing about what had happened there. 3 years on, that kind of memory is still going on, although New York is in kind of a funny place about it. You know, if people still choke up completely talking about September 11th, and people also start arguing with each other about the details now. Things are starting to slip. So remember, we were there when the second building fell. No. We saw that on television. Now, you know, and it's kind of bits and pieces of the memory are already lost, but the emotions are very strong, and the emotions were particularly strong last week because among an overwhelming majority of New Yorkers, there was a sense that their memory, their tragedy, was being blatantly exploited for political purposes by the Republican Convention. The most frequently seen kind of image was of the elephant, which is the symbol of the Republican Party, dancing on the rubble of the Twin Towers. That was the overwhelming sense in all sorts of communities in New York, not just among peace activists, not just among people who were prepared to commit acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, but among ordinary people that you spoke to about disgust that the events of 3 years ago were being used in this way to help to craft this cult of personality around the rather limp personality of George W. Bush, where you had this video before his speech at the convention, which was all turned on his heroism around September 11th, scant as that was to be seen. So one of the responses anyway last week was nonviolent civil disobedience, and that's particularly what I want to talk about. But to talk about that, I want to talk first about civil obedience, which was very much the order of the day in New York last week. There's a lot of nervousness about Bush's re-election. There was a lot of concern, hype in the media about anarchists running through the streets, breaking windows and setting fires and things like that. And there was a huge concern among huge numbers of protesters that the protests would be exploited by the Republicans for further gain. That first the tragedy would be exploited, and then kind of dreadlocked hippie protesters would be used as an image that could bolster Bush's re-election prospects. So the day before the convention started, there was a massive peaceful protest. All the protests were peaceful indeed, but there was a massive legal protest held in Manhattan. CNN started by saying tens of thousands of people. The police actually rounded it up to 100,000. The organizers said 400,000. And the New York Times, which is still in, I think, slightly apologetic mode about its role in fostering the war, actually did a proper count and came up with 500,000 people. It was an absolutely enormous demonstration, but as you may be aware, there had been a dispute with the city about the route. The organizers wanted to go to Central Park. The city didn't want them to walk on the grass, and in a sense, the protest backed down and walked along the route that the city agreed for it, with no rally at the end of it. I actually heard somebody in the crowd, a kind of a yuppie for Kerry type, say, "Well, I'm just so glad people were civil." So this kind of civil obedience that was the order of the day on the Sunday. What happened as the week went on was a kind of people found themselves taking part unconsciously in civil disobedience. That is to say, the people who thought they were going out to take part in peaceful protest found that the police regarded peaceful protest as something suspect. Sort of like the way the police are surrounding us today, taking notes and watching us from various angles, as if this gathering was a threat to the civil order. Well, that was very much the thing in New York, with constant videotaping, constant photographing, and then when you least expected it, an orange net would crop up around you and 50 people or 100 people would be taken off to Pier 57 and held for a day or two in custody in terrible conditions by the city. I was fortunate enough to escape that because my sister went into labor and I had to leave one of the protests that was rounded up in that way. But it started. In particular, the police attacked the critical mass cyclists, but they also used their motorbikes to attack crowds of peaceful protesters, particularly people of color. There was a poor people's protest on the Monday that was a legal protest that had negotiated its route with the police. Nonetheless, the police began to break it up. They began to ride motorcycles at high speed into the crowd. When the crowd reacted, there was a scuffle and there were more people arrested from that. On Tuesday, the War Resisters League attempted to remember 9/11 by walking from Ground Zero to Madison Square Garden. No sooner had they left Ground Zero, walking two abreast, which is the legal thing to do along the footpath, when the police decided that they were actually, some of them were three abreast, threw the orange netting around them and took 50 or more of them away to into custody. So this was the constant theme of the week, was that even when you didn't think you were taking part in civil disobedience, I mean, many people did deliberately get themselves arrested. On Tuesday evening, I saw Starhawk and Frida Berrigan and other people lie down and block traffic in near Herald Square and duly be arrested for their troubles, and some very moving scenes of people resisting the presence of the state and the role of the police in protecting the Republican convention in the city. But more and more people found that for standing on the footpath and cheering them on, another orange net would go around and you'd be hauled off. So in total on that evening, about 1,400 people were being arrested, and I'd say for every one that went out there to be arrested, there were four that found themselves picked up as part of the as part of the police's notion of what constituted, you know, how you treat civil obedience. The attitude toward the police was actually very friendly from the protesters. They one of the chants was give the cops a raise, because the police are in dispute with the city about their pay and conditions. But that didn't seem to matter very much to the police. It was quite chaotic, some of the police, and some individual police were polite and perfectly decent. But, you know, one group of police would sort of hustle you along to one part of the footpath, and another group of police would come along and sort of snatch you from there, as if your being there was in violation of some ordinance that, and you'd just been put there by the other police. So, in effect, what was by and large, and I think in the political context that I talked about, an extraordinarily dignified and peaceful week of imaginative and creative, some theatrical actions, the actions I talked about on the bicycles. Billionaires for Bush were on the streets confronting delegates. There were other, some people were arrested just for being in costumes at some, because they had masks, and this apparently is in violation of the city ordinance. Other people were arrested for taking the subway while carrying signs. I mean, there was really extraordinary grounds for arrest that the police were coming up with. But in the great range and hundreds of thousands of people taking part in these protests, what we saw was a kind of a police state in New York, and really a kind of a model with very much what we saw here in Dublin on May Day of a new kind of policing. More and more equipment brought in, more and more sense that before you've even started protesting, you're breaking the law. That even to plan to protest is in itself a threat. And so although there was a lot to be optimistic about, a lot of wonderful energy, although the legal march on Sunday was overwhelmingly white and middle class, many of the demonstrations during the week were full of Latinos and blacks and full of great energy and great enthusiasm and great radicalism. But at the end of it, what we were faced with was a state that takes those protests very seriously. And is prepared to crack down in ways that go way beyond what we would normally have regarded as the legal limits of civil policing. Anyway, I'll leave it at that, and I'll turn it back to Kieran. Thanks.
Okay. I've just returned from Australia, visiting my parents, which the judge finally let me do. And I'd just like to reflect on that as part of the coalition of the killing or the willing. I actually grew up in the second largest army barracks in Australia, backing onto it, and the vibe there, as I stayed at my parents' place, reminded me very much of the Vietnam period. A real sense of an army at war and an escalation of Australian complicity. We used to, in the 80s, accuse Australia of being the deputy sheriff of America. Well, that phrase has actually been embraced by both John Howard and George Bush, actually referring to the relationship that way of Australia policing the region. There are three new US bases under construction in Australia, training bases, one in my state of Queensland near Yeppoon, and 10% of the population of Yeppoon turned up against that in a demonstration recently. And then two big bases in the Northern Territory, which is a very isolated part of Australia. It's 2,000 miles from Brisbane, which is the next city to Darwin. And it's a population of only 180,000 people, 40% tribal Aborigines in that territory. So it's pretty hard to get to protest and resist. This week, with the attack on the Australian embassy in Jakarta, I think it's instructive, the kind of war that we're involved in and looks like we'll be involved in for a long time. And of course echoes a more significant attack in Bali. And when you look at the groups carrying out these attacks, both in New York City and in Bali and in Madrid, and you look at the history of these groups, it's admitted by the CIA that Al-Qaeda was set up and trained by them to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 80s. But it actually, within the Indonesian context, it precedes that. When the Suharto government came to power in the 60s, killing over 1.5 million civilians, a lot of that killing was carried out not so much by the regular army, but by fundamentalist Islamic death squads who are given license to kill the left, to wipe out the left, because at that stage Indonesia was playing both sides of the Cold War. And so significant was that coup that in Robert McNamara's autobiography he said that once we had secured the coup in Indonesia, we should have withdrawn from Vietnam, that we had locked up Southeast Asia and we could have saved ourselves a lot more domestic grief. So is that significant? And of course, in the recent attacks on the Christian community in the Moluccas and Ambon, it has been these same death squads that have taken the blank check to carry out the government or the military's will. And I think it's quite significant to know that even with the collapse of Suharto, with his standing down, with the expose in East Timor, after the Indonesian military were clearly exposed carrying out a scorched earth policy as they left after 25 years of invasion, then nothing of this has damaged the status or the power of the Indonesian military and Indonesian political life. And I think under Clinton there was a policy of the Indonesian military are so corrupt and Indonesia is so significant in terms of the fourth or fifth largest country in the world, it has enormous resources, that their military are so corrupt that it was actually damaging to American economic interests, and they hope to replace them with a new breed of technocrats. And but they have not budged. They have not suffered from the expose in East Timor. All the charges were dropped in the past week on the military commanders who are in charge of that killing. And the Australian military intelligence, I think, would admit off the record that they believe the Indonesian military deeply involved in the attack on Bali, that their relationships with groups of an Al-Qaeda nature go way back to the 1960s. And the attack this week, I think most people with any kind of insight at all would see the hand of the mainstream Indonesian regular army in it. So it's really a history we haven't confronted as Australians, in both in our complicity in the genocide in East Timor, where our SAS trained the Kopassus elite death squads year after year, Indonesian regular army troops were trained near my city in jungle warfare training, etc., and our robbery of the Timor Sea oil resources, etc. And until we really confront where this phenomenon comes from and how we are complicit in it, and especially the nature of the Saudi Arabian regime, this killing and these attacks, whether it's on Madrid commuters or Aussie tourists in Bali or New York people, will continue, because the roots of the problem are not being addressed, as obviously people like Michael Moore have exposed in the mainstream media. I just want to say anything about Irish complicity and then move into the region.
Yeah, I guess what we are here today for is to commemorate those who died on September 11 in New York, those who have died subsequent to that in Afghanistan and Iraq. And in about 5 minutes or so, or less than that, hopefully Brendan will be able to continue to play the harp as others maintain a vigil. And I will be calling out some of the deaths of, or some of the names of the people who died in New York on a terrible day 3 years ago, and also the people who have died in Afghanistan, the US military casualties in Iraq, Iraqi civilians' names as well. I guess one of the major problems that Kris Kristofferson even pointed out in one of his songs is that like the US military and various other militaries don't take the names of those who they kill. It has been even very, very difficult to get the names of civilians who have died in Afghanistan. How is Ireland complicit, and why are we here at the US Embassy in Dublin? Well, one of the main reasons that we're here is to also protest against the Irish government's complicity in this war on terror by allowing 10,000 US troops to transit through Shannon Airport each month. In 2003, approximately 125,000 US troops passed through with various munitions of war, and unfortunately there has been no transparency or accountability about what is actually going on. There has been some information coming out through former Commandant Ed Horgan's case against the Taoiseach and against the government, that their complicity in allowing Shannon to be used was unconstitutional, that certainly under international law Ireland had facilitated a belligerent state engaged in war, and that it had jeopardized and neutralized our traditional policy of neutrality. It is our hope today to try and communicate to the people in Ireland who are passing by, and to the people in Ireland who may be reading newspapers or anything tomorrow, to realize that just because people are against war, and just because people are standing outside the US Embassy on September 11th to commemorate the civilians of Iraq and Afghanistan and various other countries who have been killed, it doesn't mean that we are anti-American. We believe that we are pro the American people against the exploitation of the US government. We would hope that the Irish people will also continue to non-violently resist the Irish government's complicity in this war on terror. It's really summed up in the banner that we have over here. It's a quote from Father Daniel Berrigan, a veteran anti-war activist in the United States and pacifist. It says, "War on terror is war. War is terror is war." And the more we actually respond to terror by war, the more the terror continues. We should also remember that the United States are the only government to have been convicted as a terrorist state by the World Court. We have a very complex relationship with the United States here in Ireland. We like the multinational companies, we like the beautiful economic circumstances that have surrounded us in the last 10 to 15 years, but at what price? That's the most important question to ask today. Can we nourish a culture, can we nourish an environment where we don't have to invest in armaments, where we can actually begin to enact and enflesh the disarmament of military equipment which kills innocent people, and actually start investing in healthcare and education and all the other needs that are very, very obvious in Ireland today? September 11th, finally, is also the anniversary, actually, that a very famous person in Ireland at the moment and great social justice activist, Father Peter McFerry, first moved into a tenement up in Summerhill. He's a Jesuit priest, a great advocate of people who have been the forgotten in Ireland over the last 30 years. And the Celtic Tiger wage is on, and the various cars that are going by drowning out my voice at the moment is testimony to that. But we must remember that the people that we work with in the homeless shelters in Dublin here, who suffer from addiction, who suffer from mental health issues, that we need to start showing them more compassion and to listen. We needed to listen to the people of New York afterwards, And that didn't mean that it was going to be retributive justice, but we need to restore justice. We need to listen to the families of the people who have died in Afghanistan and the people who have died in Iraq. We also need to listen to the US military people's, US military coalition casualties also. We need to listen to their families and to try and understand the nature of war and how we can actually bring it to an end and nourish a peaceful society. So without further ado, maybe we should maintain a 1 minute silence. 1 minute silence, and then after that, Brenda will start playing the harp and I will begin the calling out of the names of the dead.
Read out a few of the names in New York and